Hi, I'm Bruce, and I'll be reading news articles from USA Today for Friday, April 16th. Trump, Iran, at odds, days into ceasefire. Will peace last? By Zach Anderson and Michael Loria. The fragile ceasefire between the United States and Iran was showing signs of strain Friday ahead of expected peace talks as the Strait of Hormuz remained largely closed. Israel expanded its military campaign against Lebanon and Iran made clear its demands were not being met. President Donald Trump on Thursday threatened Iran and complained it is not holding up its end of the ceasefire deal. The shooting starts bigger and better and stronger than anyone has ever seen before, Trump said. Later, he added, Iran is doing a very poor job, dishonorable, some would say, of allowing oil to go through the Strait of Hormuz. That is not the agreement we have. Fractures in the truce come as Israel launched its deadliest day of attacks on Lebanon of the war. Iran's ally, Hezbollah, is based in the country bordering Israel. Hundreds were killed and over 1,000 wounded in the wake of the ceasefire. Iran signaled that any deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz will be contingent upon Israel ceasing its campaign in Lebanon. The country's leader demanded reparations and appeared interested in extending Iran's control over the critical oil shipping lane. The back and forth between the two sides comes as peace talks are expected to take place in Pakistan over the weekend and in Washington, D.C., next week. Vice President J.D. Vance is leading a U.S. delegation to Islamabad for the talks. Vice President Vance has described the Iran war ceasefire as a fragile truce. Starting Saturday, he'll be tasked with negotiating in person with Iranian officials to see if he can turn the two-week ceasefire deal into something more lasting and durable. Vance is heading to Pakistan with Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff for negotiations aimed at achieving a permanent settlement to end the war. Pakistan has served as a key intermediary between U.S. officials and the regime in Tehran. Trump said, after the ceasefire was announced, that it was a big day for world peace. Whether it can hold remains to be seen, with both sides complaining about the other not abiding by the terms. Traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, the oil shipping lane that has become perhaps the core issue of the war, declined on the first day of a ceasefire, according to an analysis of vessel movements. The analysis by Maritime News of K-Plur risk and compliance data found five ships passed through the strait on Wednesday, the first day of the ceasefire, down from 11 vessels on the day before. The reopening of the channel is a core tenet of the ceasefire agreement for the United States and Israel. Iranian state media reported the country would not grant safe passage to vessels if Israel did not cease its attacks on Lebanon, where Israel's ally Hezbollah is based. According to the analysis, the operating environment in the strait therefore remains unchanged, with permissive passings continuing under the same conditions as before. The findings contradict statements from the White House that traffic through the strait has increased since the ceasefire agreement. President Donald Trump responded to reports that Iran will become an effective toll operator for the Strait of Hormuz, with a statement slamming the idea. There are reports that Iran is charging fees to tankers going through the Hormuz Strait, the president wrote in a Thursday post on Truth Social. They better not be, and if they are, they better stop now, President Donald J. Trump. Trump's comments come shortly after Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Mojtaba Khamenei, posted a statement that Iran would definitely take the management of the Strait of Hormuz to a new phase. The president's comments come after he floated the idea of the United States charging tolls on ships passing through the strait. We have a concept where we'll charge tolls, Trump said on April 6th. U.S. officials will host peace talks between Israel and Lebanon in Washington, D.C. next week, the State Department confirmed to USA Today. The talks between the two sides come as the United States and Israel remain at odds with Iran over whether the ceasefire extends to Lebanon, where Iran's ally Hezbollah is based. Hezbollah launched strikes on Israel in response to the killing of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Israel has responded with a massive bombing campaign and invasion of the southern part of the country. On Wednesday, the first day of the ceasefire, Israel hit Lebanon with its deadliest barrage of strikes of the war, killing hundreds and leveling buildings in Beirut. Talks are expected to take place shortly after top Trump administration officials traveled to Pakistan over the weekend for peace negotiations with Iran. The State Department confirmation of upcoming talks comes in response to reporting by Al Monitor that Lebanese officials would travel to Washington for negotiations. The news and opinion site focused on the Middle East cited a senior Lebanese official. Who is helped more by ceasefire? Hidden details to decide ultimately, expert says, by Josh Maya. The Trump administration and Iranian leaders have both claimed victory in the temporarily paused U.S.-Israel war on Iran, even as details of the two-week ceasefire are being disputed. So who actually blinked first, and who really came out on top? There is no clear answer, with much of the details hidden beneath layers of secretive multi-party negotiations and changing dynamics. And key details remain in dispute, including the future of Iranian's uranium enrichment program and whether the ceasefire applies to Israeli military action in Lebanon, which already threatens to unravel the shaky detente. As of mid-afternoon, April 8th, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt acknowledged that while the U.S. has seen some movement, the strait through which 20% of the world's oil passes was not fully open for business. We have seen an uptick in traffic in the strait today, and I will reiterate the president's expectation and demand that the Strait of Hormuz is reopened immediately, quickly, and safely, Leavitt said. Later in the day, Vice President J.D. Vance told reporters Wednesday in Budapest, Hungary, if we don't see that happening, the president is not going to abide by our terms if the Iranians are not abiding by their terms. Here's what we know. about initial winners and losers in the ceasefire, which was announced just hours before Trump's 8 p.m. Eastern Time deadline on April 7th for Iran to open the strait or face annihilation. What are both sides saying? Trump delayed the strikes on Iran that he said would wipe out a whole civilization after receiving a 10-point proposal from the Islamic Republic that he said provided a workable basis for negotiations. The morning after the ceasefire was announced, Pentagon's Chief Pete Hegseth declared the U.S. military campaign on Iran a historic and overwhelming victory. Hegseth said the U.S. armed forces achieved every military objective set out at the start of the war, including the destruction of Iran's Navy, Air Force, and weapons manufacturing infrastructure. President Trump forged this moment, he said. Iran begged for this ceasefire, and we all know it. Iran's Supreme National Security Council also claimed victory following a ceasefire deal Tuesday evening, saying the United States and Israel were forced to accept Tehran's 10-point plan. Levitt disputed public claims about the 10-point plan circulating publicly, including by the Iranian government. The real details, Levitt said, at a White House news conference, are being discussed in back-channel negotiations between Washington and Tehran that are being facilitated by the government of Pakistan. A meeting is set for this weekend in the capital of Islamabad, and Vance is scheduled to attend, the White House said. What does Iran's ceasefire proposal actually do? Iran's exact proposal has not been made public, but many versions of it circulating publicly call for American troops to leave the Middle East, for Iran to continue its control over the strategic strait, and to maintain its right to nuclear enrichment. In a public statement, Iran's Supreme National Security Council said its own officials and Iran's Supreme Leader, Mujtaba Khamenei, approved the plan. The statement is long and rambling and full of religious references and attacks on the United States and Israel, Washington's partner in the war on Iran, as global evil Zionism, according to a translation of it by Middle East Eye, an independent news and analysis site. But the statement by the Iranian Council includes some specifics of Iran's proposal that it said the United States accepts as a starting point, including controlled passage through the Strait of Hormuz in coordination with Iran's armed forces and ending U.S. and Israeli military aggressions against Iran and its Lebanese proxy fighting force Hezbollah. It also includes the withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from all bases and deployment points in the region, the full payment of Iran's damages from the war, and the removal of all primary and secondary sanctions against Iran, including the release of all blocked Iranian properties and assets abroad, the statement said. Now, the Honorable Prime Minister of Pakistan has informed Iran that the American side, despite all outward threats, has accepted these principles as the basis for negotiations and has surrendered to the will of the Iranian nation, the statement said. When the details of Tehran's 10-point plan are finalized, it said, Iran's victory on the field shall also be considered consolidated in political negotiations. What is the Trump administration saying? Both Vance and Levitt said in their public remarks that elements of the Iranian regime is lying about the nature of the ceasefire agreement. Both also emphasized that the truce is a fragile one. The Iranians originally put forward a 10-point plan that was fundamentally unserious, unacceptable, and completely discarded, Levitt said at the White House briefing. Levitt did not disclose any details of the new modified plan, but said Trump determined it formed a workable basis on which to negotiate and to align it with our own 15-point proposal. The president's red lines, namely the end of Iranian enrichment in Iran, have not changed, she said. And the idea that President Trump would ever accept an Iranian wish list as a deal is completely absurd. Since the ceasefire was announced, conflicting accounts have emerged, for instance, over whether Lebanon is included in the agreement. Pakistan, one of the deal's mediators, and Iran said the pause in fighting would indeed extend to Lebanon. Israel has denied this, while Trump has said the Israeli war on Hezbollah is a separate skirmish. What are Trump's critics saying? Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, a member of the Foreign Relations Committee and a vocal critic of Trump, posted on X some details of Iran's 10-point plan that he said was from an account close to the Iranian leadership. The account said that during the ceasefire, only about 10 to 15 ships will be permitted to pass through the Strait of Hormuz with Iran's approval, in coordination with Iran's navy, and after payment of tolls and a commitment to remove a U.S. freeze on Iranian assets. Tehran will also control and toll the strait for the first time, the ex-posting cited by Murphy said. They keep their nuclear program. They keep their missiles. We are now seeing the shape of why Iran agreed so enthusiastically to this ceasefire, Murphy said. What a disaster. Another taco move, or Trump always chickens out? Numerous observers said agreeing to a ceasefire with Iran was another example of Trump's taco, short for Trump always chickens out, a term that first went viral during Trump's on-again, off-again tariff policies. This was no ordinary Trump taco. This was Trump accepting Iran's victory conditions as the basis of negotiations, said Phillips O'Brien, a professor of strategic studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland and author of the 2025 book War and Power, Who Wins Wars and Why. It looks likely that Iran will emerge stronger from this war than before, a total U.S. strategic failure, O'Brien said in an April 8th post on X. Strong first step toward holding Iran accountable. Some of Trump's supporters in Congress cheered Trump's acceptance of a short-term ceasefire as a smart tactical victory. Excellent news, Republican Senator Rick Scott of Florida said shortly after Trump announced the ceasefire. This is a strong first step toward holding Iran accountable, and what happens when you have a leader who puts peace through strength over chaos and weak appeasement of policies. The president has been clear. Iran must never have a nuclear weapon. The Strait of Hormuz must be completely opened, and our country and our great ally Israel must never be threatened again by Iran or its proxies, Scott said. Gas prices, top of mind for many amid war. by Keith Lang. Rising gas prices remain a top concern for Americans amid a two-week ceasefire between the United States and Iran that was announced by President Donald Trump on April 7th. According to a new poll released April 7th by the Pew Research Center, 69% of Americans say they are concerned. About facing higher gas and fuel prices if hostilities between the United States and Iran resume after the conclusion of the two-week ceasefire. Among Democrats and people who lean toward voting for Democratic candidates, the poll found 79% identified rising gas prices as their top concern about the now-paused war in Iran. Among Republicans and people who lean toward voting for Republicans, the poll found 59% said escalating gas prices were their top concern. The Pew Center said the survey was conducted March 23rd through 29th among 3,507 U.S. adults. About 7 in 10 Americans, 69%, are concerned about higher gas and fuel prices as a result of the U.S. military action against Iran, including 45% who are extremely concerned, the group said. Of the potential outcomes we asked about, this one worries Americans most. The findings also come as the national average gas price rose to $4.16 per gallon on April 8th. According to AAA, that figure is up from a national average of $3.25 one month ago on March 8th. How long for gas prices to come down if the ceasefire holds? Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy, said oil and gas prices are already showing signs of coming down in the wake of the announcement of the temporary ceasefire between the United States and Iran. Gas prices could start reversing nationally in 48 hours or so, by a few cents every day, DeHaan said in an X post on the evening of April 7th after Trump announced the ceasefire agreement. Diesel prices may lag slightly, but where things stand now, diesel is no longer likely to reach a record. National average gasoline could fall below $4 in 1 to 2 weeks, diesel $5 in 6 to 8 weeks. DeHaan added in an April 8th X post that there are already huge drops in oil markets, and for now, he said, lower fuel prices should be coming soon. DeHaan cautioned in an April 7th blog post that markets remain highly sensitive to developments in the region. He said short-term reductions in U.S. gas prices could reverse if hostilities between the United States and Iran resume after the temporary ceasefire. Until there is clear progress towards reopening the strait or achieving a durable de-escalation, oil prices are likely to remain elevated and volatile, with geopolitical developments continuing to dominate market direction, he wrote. What can cause wide swings in gas prices across the country? Regional differences in gas prices can be explained by several factors, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Among these are differences in state and local gas taxes, distance from supply, supply disruptions, retail competition, and operating costs. Environmental programs. Retail gasoline prices tend to be higher the further gasoline must be transported to the point of sale because of transportation costs are higher, the agency said. Anything that slows or stops gasoline production can result in increased bidding for available gasoline supplies, the agency added. Prices at gasoline stations are often highest in locations with fewer gasoline stations. Michigan man arrested in wife's disappearance on Bahamas boat trip, by Amanda Lee Myers. Authorities in the Bahamas have arrested a Michigan man 4 days after his wife went missing during a nighttime boat ride that left the couple's family questioning his account of what happened. The Royal Bahamas Police Department arrested Brian Hooker, 59, on April 8th. The agency says he was being questioned in connection with the disappearance of his wife, 55-year-old Lynette Hooker. Advado Dames, Assistant Commissioner of the Royal Bahamas Police, identified Brian Hooker as a suspect in a phone interview with Reuters. A U.S. Coast Guard official told USA Today earlier, April 8th, that the agency was also conducting a criminal investigation into Hooker's disappointment. On April 4th, Brian Hooker reported that his wife fell overboard from an 8-foot hard-bottom dinghy that they were taking on a night trip from Hopetown to Elbow Bay, which are both off of Great Abaco Island, according to a news release from the Royal Bahamas Police Department. Brian Hooker said that his wife had been carrying the boat keys, so the engine shut off when she fell. Then, strong currents subsequently carried her away, and he lost sight of her, police said. The agency said that Brian Hooker then paddled the dinghy to shore, which took hours, and that he arrived around 4 a.m. on April 5th. I am heartbroken over the recent boat accident in unpredictable seas and high winds that caused my beloved Lynette to fall from our small dinghy near Elbow Cay in the Bahamas, Brian Hooker wrote on Facebook about 12 hours after his arrest. Despite desperate attempts to reach her, the winds and currents drove us further apart. We continue to search for her, and that is my sole focus. Lynette and Brian Hooker have been documenting their sailing adventures on social media for years, describing themselves on TikTok as a married couple living their best life after they sailed away from BS. They've sailed to New Orleans, Miami Beach, Key West, on Lake Michigan, and most recently throughout the Bahamas. Lynette Hooker's daughter, Carly Aylesworth, told multiple news outlets that it doesn't make sense that her mother would fall off the dinghy, saying that she was a fit and experienced mariner. She also described the couple's relationship as volatile and said it involved domestic violence. Brian Hooker has not granted any interviews and did not respond to USA Today's request for comment on April 8th. Here's what we know so far about the investigation into Lynette Hooker's disappearance. What have police said about the investigation? The Royal Bahamas Police Department, the lead agency in the case, has said that their investigation into Lynette Hooker's disappearance remains active, but released very few details before announcing Brian Hooker's arrest. In a news release on Tuesday, April 7th, the Royal Bahamas Police said that extensive search and rescue efforts for Hooker have included professional divers, drone technology, and a U.S. Coast Guard helicopter. Though the agency described search operations as active, it's now considered a recovery operation. Richard Cook, team leader with the Hopetown Volunteer Fire and Rescue, told NBC News. Neither that agency nor Bahamian police responded to USA Today's request for more information on Wednesday, April 8th. The Royal Bahamas Police Department is asking members of the public who may have information that could help the investigation to contact them by dialing 911 or 919 or anonymously by calling 328 or 8477. Social media paints Brian and Lynette Hooker as living out a retiree's dream, sailing wherever they feel like it on their own yacht, dubbed Soulmate, and complete with a Detroit Lions flag. Their home base is listed as Onsted, about 35 miles southwest of Ann Arbor. The couple has been documenting their travels on Facebook, TikTok, and on Instagram as the Sailing Hookers. Their posts include grinning selfies, adventures such as snorkeling and scuba diving, and humble brags about enjoying the weather in the Bahamas while their loved ones back in Michigan freeze. Doctor found guilty of trying to kill his wife on hike in Hawaii by Tao Nguyen and Nadia Yancey Bragg. A Hawaii doctor who has been charged with trying to kill his wife on a birthday hike in 2025 was convicted April 8th of attempted manslaughter based upon extreme mental or emotional disturbance. Following a three-week trial, a Honolulu County jury returned the verdict against Gerhard Koenig, 47, after about a day of deliberations. The jury did not convict Koenig of the higher charge of second-degree attempted murder. The attempted manslaughter charge carries a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison. Koenig's sentencing is scheduled for August 13th. Thomas Otake, Koenig's attorney, said he planned to appeal. Koenig was arrested in March 2025 after the Honolulu Police Department said he attempted to push his wife, Arielle Koenig, off a cliffside hiking trail in Oahu and struck her in the head with a rock. At the time, police said Arielle Koenig was taken to the hospital in critical condition. Gerhard Koenig, an anesthesiologist based in Maui, was nowhere to be found when authorities responded to the scene, but he was arrested after an hours-long manhunt. He had pleaded not guilty to second-degree attempted murder following his arrest and indictment last year. Husband and wife give conflicting accounts. During the trial, the jury heard testimony about an emotional affair, a marriage on the rocks, and two very different accounts of a hellish birthday hike. Prosecutors accused Gerhard Koenig of trying to kill his wife by attempting to inject her with a mysterious syringe and shove her off of a cliff. When that attempt failed, prosecutors and Ariel Koenig said he started hitting her with a rock. No syringe was found at the scene. Two other hikers had partly witnessed the assault and corroborated Ariel Koenig's account of what happened during the beating. The assault had left Ariel Koenig covered in blood and suffering from bruising, a complex laceration of the scalp, and a fractured thumb, according to photos shown and testimony heard during the trial. "I just started screaming because in my mind he's trying to knock me unconscious to be able to drag me over the edge. I was just screaming then as much as I could," she testified. Emil Koenig, Gerhard Koenig's son, also testified during the trial that his father called him on Facebook time after the attack occurred and confessed while splattered with her blood. Emil Koenig said his father told him he would not be making it back to Maui and to take good care of the younger kids, and that Ari, my stepmom, had been cheating on him and he tried to kill her. But Gerhard Koenig denied that he plotted to kill his wife or that he confessed to the crime. He testified that he had been attacked first and acted in self-defense, saying his wife pulled him to the ground, grabbed him by the testicles, and hit him in the face with a rock. "Such a majestic view for Artemis crew," by Janine Santucci. The four astronauts on the Artemis II mission that took them around the moon spent years preparing for the historic flight, practicing operating the Orion spacecraft, learning how to observe the moon's geography, and even training in photography. The mission took NASA's Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Canadian Space Agency Jeremy Hansen to distances farther from the Earth than any person had ever gone before. They rehearsed every possible scenario, but what they experienced when they got up there still managed to catch them off guard. "I don't know what we all expected to see," Wiseman said after the crew members got the first full glimpse of their home planet from space. "It was the most spectacular moment, and it paused all four of us in our tracks. There is nothing normal about this." Sending four humans 250,000 miles away is a Herculean effort, and we are now just realizing the gravity of that, he said. As the crew completed a 10-day journey, they kept describing the experience as awe-inspiring, beautiful, and above all, impossible to fully describe with words. Those of us back on Earth got to follow along with the breathtaking photos they sent back, but it's an experience and perspective that very few people in the world can truly share. Hansen said he hopes they won't be the last. "As we surpass the furthest distance humans have ever traveled from planet Earth, we do so in honoring the extraordinary efforts and feats of our predecessors in human space exploration. We will continue our journey even further into space before Mother Earth succeeds in pulling us back to everything that we hold dear," Hansen said. "But we most importantly choose this moment to challenge this generation and the next to make sure this record is not long-lived." Majestic views from space included Earth, dark, and the dark side of the moon. Observers following along with Artemis's two journey from back on Earth excitedly waited for updates and new photos from the crew, but even the seasoned space travelers couldn't contain their excitement at what they were seeing. The journey produced stunning photos, including one of Earth that captured incredible detail, such as auroras lighting up the atmosphere. As the crew made it to the halfway point between the Earth and the Moon, NASA shared an update at midnight on April 4th. "We all had a collective expression of joy at that," Cook said. "We can see the Moon out of the docking hatch right now. It's a beautiful sight." The incredible views kept coming. On April 6th, the crew entered the most spectacular phase of the mission, an hours-long lunar flyby phase, during which they got to see roughly 20% of the so-called dark side of the Moon, illuminated by sunlight. They were the first humans to ever see parts of the Moon with unaided eyes. "Such a majestic view out here," Wiseman told the mission crew back on the ground during the flyby. On that day, they got to see an Earth set, in which the Earth dropped below the lunar horizon, and a stunning view of the Moon eclipsing the Sun. "No matter how long we look at this, our brains are not processing this image in front of us. It is absolutely spectacular, surreal. I know there's no adjectives. I'm going to need to invent some new ones to describe what we are looking at out this window," Wiseman said. Space exploration reminds astronauts we're all one people. As they looked down on their home planet from great distances, the astronauts got the unique opportunity to experience what has been dubbed the overview effect, a phenomenon caused by seeing the Earth from space that can shift astronauts' perspectives on life itself. Space philosopher Frank White coined the phrase in 1987, and astronauts for decades have described a similar feeling, a realization that everyone back on Earth shares more in common than we realize. Borders and divisions aren't visible from space. "Trust us, you look amazing. You look beautiful," Glover said on April 2nd. "And from up here, you also look like one thing. Homo sapiens, all of us, no matter where you're from or what you look like, we're all one people." Gates latest to face scrutiny by Congress. Microsoft co-founder to testify about Epstein. By Fernando Cervantes Jr. Bill Gates is the latest powerful figure drawn into the congressional scrutiny as newly released Department of Justice files tied to Jeffrey Epstein continue being prominent names in the spotlight. The Microsoft co-founder is scheduled to sit for a transcribed interview with the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee on June 10th, a source familiar with the proceedings confirmed to USA Today. Gates has previously said he had several dinners with Epstein, believing at the time that Epstein would use his wealthy connections to fundraise for global health causes. While he never witnessed or participated in any of Epstein's illegal conduct, he is looking forward to answering the committee's questions to support their important work, a Gates spokesperson told The Hill. Here are some of the other prominent names that have been called before lawmakers to answer questions about Epstein. Bill and Hillary Clinton. Former President Bill Clinton denied wrongdoing in his relationship with Epstein when House Republicans grilled him on February 27th about the late financier's fundraising, numerous visits to the White House, and pictures in DOJ files. He told lawmakers in his opening statement that he had no idea of the crimes Epstein was committing and dismissed the significance of his appearance in decades-old photographs included in the records tied to Epstein's estate. A day later, on February 26th, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told lawmakers that she never met Epstein, never flew on his plane, or visited his private island. She acknowledged knowing Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell casually. Like every decent person, I've been horrified by what we have learned about their crimes, Hillary Clinton said. Les Wexner. Also in February, billionaire retail executive Les Wexner appeared before Congress following a subpoena issued by the House Democrats and described Epstein as a world-class con man who had deceived him according to his testimony. Wexner, who built companies including Victoria's Secret and Abercrombie and Fitch, acknowledged that Epstein had previously served as a personal advisor with broad authority over multi-million dollar financial matters. He denied knowing about Epstein's crimes or participating in the abuse of girls and young women, PBS News reported. Howard Lutnick. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick has also agreed to testify voluntarily before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, with his appearance scheduled for May 6th, according to committee leadership. The secretary has proactively agreed to appear voluntarily before the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, Committee Chair James Comer, Republican from Kentucky, wrote in a post on X. I commend his demonstrated commitment to transparency. Lutnick previously told senators in February that he had visited Epstein's private island in December 2012 and brought his wife, four children, and their nannies. He said he couldn't recall why they were at the island, Little St. James, but that he saw no inappropriate activity. Pam Bondi. Former Attorney General Pam Bondi became a focal point of congressional scrutiny following the release of the Epstein files, with lawmakers sharply criticizing the DOJ's handling of the disclosures. Tensions peaked during a contentious February 11th hearing before the House Judiciary Committee, marked by heated exchanges between Bondi and House Democrats. Following that testimony, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee subpoenaed Bondi to appear again on April 14th to answer further questions related to the Epstein files. Lawmakers say the Epstein investigation is far from over, setting the stage for more high-profile names to be called before Congress. Woman is sentenced in Perry's death. Ketamine Queen gets 15 years in Starr's overdose, by Edward Segarra. Jasveen Sangha, the woman who distributed ketamine resulting in Friends star Matthew Perry's 2023 death, has received her sentence in the criminal case. U.S. District Judge Sherilyn Garnett sentenced Sangha, described by prosecutors as the ketamine queen of North Hollywood, to 15 years in prison during a hearing at the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California on April 8th. The verdict matches the recommended sentence federal prosecutors had argued for, which is harsher than the penalties received by any of Sangha's four co-defendants in the case. To cultivate her business, Sangha marketed herself as an exclusive dealer who catered to high-profile Hollywood clientele, prosecutors argued in a sentencing memorandum. While Sangha worked to expand and profit from her drug trafficking, she knew and disregarded the grave harm her conduct was causing. USA Today has reached out to attorneys for Sangha and U.S. prosecutors for comment. Perry was best known for his role as the wisecracking Chandler Bing on the NBC sitcom, was found dead in a jacuzzi at his Los Angeles home in October 2023, following a decades-long battle with substance abuse. The mysterious circumstances surrounding the 54-year-old's death sparked a criminal investigation that led to several arrests, including Sangha. The ruling comes 7 months after Sangha pleaded guilty to 5 felony charges in Perry's overdose death, 1 count of maintaining a drug-involved premises, 3 counts of distribution of ketamine, and 1 count of distribution of ketamine resulting in death or serious bodily injury. She originally faced up to 65 years in prison, prosecutors previously said. There is a statutory maximum prison sentence of 20 years for the charge related to the drug-involved premises, up to 10 years for each of the 3 ketamine distribution counts, and a maximum of 15 years for distributing ketamine that resulted in Perry's death. Prosecutors say that in October 2023, Sangha worked with Eric Fleming, described as Perry's acquaintance, to sell 51 vials of ketamine to the actor's live-in assistant, Kenneth Iwamasa. Iwamasa injected Perry with the short-acting anesthetic. Fleming and Iwamasa previously reached plea deals with prosecutors. All 5 defendants who faced charges over Perry's death have pleaded guilty. Sangha, Fleming, Iwamasa, Dr. Salvador Plasencia, Dr. Mark Chavez. A December 2023 autopsy report revealed that Perry's death was an accident, with the cause being the acute effects of ketamine. Contributing factors were drowning, coronary artery disease, and the effects of buprenorphine. Matthew Perry's parents appear at Sangha's sentencing hearing. Perry's parents, Mother Suzanne Perry and stepfather Keith Morrison, were in attendance at Sangha's sentencing hearing, as seen in photos from the legal proceeding. In one photo, Perry's mom and the Dateline correspondent can be seen walking hand in hand as they arrive at the Edward R. Roybal Federal Courthouse in Los Angeles. Suzanne Perry reflected on Perry's death and struggles with substance abuse in an October 2024 interview on the Today Show, which coincided with the one-year anniversary of her son's death. "It hits me so hard that he's not there," Suzanne Perry said. "I'm a very lucky woman. There was one glitch, and that was one problem that I couldn't conquer. I couldn't help him." Is Sangha in jail? Yes, Sangha has been incarcerated since August 2024. Before her sentencing, defense attorneys had urged the judge to limit her sentence to time already served. Sangha's sentencing comes after plea reversal. Sangha previously pleaded not guilty to all charges against her, with attorney Mark Garagos maintaining her innocence in a Peacock documentary special that was released last February. My client never met Matthew Perry, had nothing to do with Matthew Perry, and all the supposed rumors otherwise are just that, urban legend. Garago said in an interview that was included in the special, "This theory that this so-called fatal dose is linked to my client is absolute garbage." However, according to Sanghar's September plea agreement, she had been storing, packaging, and distributing drugs such as methamphetamine and ketamine at her home since June 2019. Sanghar, in her plea agreement, admitted to selling ketamine that led to the overdose death of Los Angeles resident Cody McClary in 2019, 4 years before Perry's death. In an August 2024 press release, prosecutors pointed to the McClary's death as evidence that Sanghar was aware of the danger of ketamine. As part of her guilty plea, she will be required to pay full restitution to the victims, Perry and McClary. Perry's stepmother makes an emotional statement. The day before Sanghar's sentencing, prosecutors filed a victim impact statement on behalf of Perry's stepmother, Debbie Perry. "The pain you've caused to hundreds, maybe thousands, is irreversible. There is no joy to be found, no light in the window," Debbie Perry, who is married to Perry's father, John Bennett Perry, wrote. "You caused this," Debbie Perry said. "You, who has talent for business, enough to make money, chose the one way that hurts people. How sad for you. How will you ever find joy? Have you ever found joy? How sad for us all. We miss him." Debbie Perry ended her letter by asking the court to hand out a maximum prison sentence so that Sanghar won't be able to hurt other families like ours.